the case of Riemann manifolds and the Zöller Riemann manifolds. We didn't really go deeply into the causal structure that comes with resonance wave when the metric is not possibly different. However, there are some very important things that are different when we work with an indefinite metric, such as Minkowski spacetime. And some features of having a Lorentzian manifold are really very surprising. And one of those things we'll start off with today, we will cover two general areas. Local features of the causal structure of the spacetime, and after that, the beginnings of the global features. We are heading towards singularity theory. You see, we know, of course, and you've seen that probably in the first course on general relativity, that spacetime can have singularities. General relativity admits that. However, as you will see, it's a very non-trivial question whether singularities actually can occur, whether the dynamics of spacetime is such that singularities under certain circumstances are unavoidable. It could be that you need an incredible fine-tuning for singularity to occur, in which case you wouldn't expect them to exist. And those singularity theorems take care of that and show that under certain circumstances, the occurrence of a singularity is guaranteed, at least with a classical theory. But we start off today with local properties of the causal structure of space-time. And we'll start out with something that's, I think, quite surprising. So remember that the metric is one way of defining the shape of a manifold. It applies to Riemannian as well as to Zöller-Riemann manifold. But more than that, if what we're dealing with is a space-time, then the metric tells us in particular about space-like and time-like vectors. Using the metric, you can evaluate for every tangent vector whether it is space-like or time-like. If its length is negative, it's time-like. If its length is positive, it's space-like, according to our sign convention. And if the length of the vector is zero, then it's light-like. It could be the tangent vector of a light. So the metric does more than just describe the shape of the manifold in terms of space-time. It also tells us about causality, because things can only propagate along time or light-like curves, and they can never propagate along space-like curves because of causality. Now, let's prepare ourselves for what's coming up. We need the definition of a convex normal neighbor. I don't know how long we'd have to hear that. Put the cameraman, please switch off the buzzing there. That's better. Okay, we need the definition of a convex normal neighborhood. What is that? Consider arbitrary point P of the manifold. Then, a convex normal neighborhood is a neighborhood of that point, in which it is true that any two points are connected by one geodesic, and just one geodesic. That's a non-trivial thing, because you can imagine that if space is sufficiently curved and the distances you're looking at are sufficiently large, then two different geodesics could get you from the same starting point to the same ending. I mean, you could go in a geodesic this way around the sun and arrive somewhere, or that way around the sun and arrive at the same point at the same time. So it's not all that exotic to have geodesics the two geodesics get you from the same point to the same point. Now, a neighborhood is sufficiently small, it's called a convex normal neighborhood, if any two points in that neighborhood of the point P are connected by exactly one geodesic. So that's a definition, and it is a lemma that in principle needs to be proved, but you won't prove it here. It's kind of obvious. Namely, that there are, for every point of a space-time, there always exists a sufficiently small neighborhood which is of that type, which is geodesically convex. So convex normal neighborhoods always exist. Now, let us assume that U, capital U, is a convex neighborhood, convex normal neighborhood. So at least two points in that neighborhood are connected by exactly one unit. Then let us choose in this neighborhood a charge, a coordinate system, and symbolically we will draw a line here of x stands for all space-like directions, and t stands for time-like direction. Then we plot the point P, and we look at the path-like cone of that point. Depending on what coordinate system we choose, that path-like cone could be some awkward curve, of course. Even in Minkowski space, you can choose coordinates such as the path-like cone looks like that. But generally, there may be curvature, and then that's also representing not just the choice of coordinates, but also the presence of curvature. So all the points which have the same time coordinate, but different space coordinate, form a space-like hypersurface. Okay? And we will use that term later on very often. Now here's an important definition. We say that the laws of nature are locally causal if the value of fields, of physical fields, of magnetic fields, at this point depends only on the value of the magnetic fields inside its past life course. And in particular, if we look at an early time, let's say t equals zero, then it should be possible to calculate the value that all possible fields, all matter fields, take at this point from just knowing the values of the fields on this stretch. If the laws of nature are indeed causal, and we are assuming this, or what you would say locally causal, if the laws of nature are locally causal, then the value of any field over here cannot be influenced by whatever value the fields took outside of this slide cone. So over here or over there. If we focus on one particular matter field, let's say there's just one matter field in nature, it could of course have lots of indices and therefore stand for indeed all species, then what we are saying is that the amplitude of psi here can depend on the amplitude of psi over there only, well, and its derivatives. cameraman, can you please switch off the wealth column? Okay. By the way, this is something that wouldn't hold true in Newtonian gravity. In Newtonian gravity, the speed of light is infinite, and therefore the path light cone is, well, it's like that. Everything in the path could influence this point. So it's a very special feature of relativity that the path light cone is finite. Almost claustrophobic, right? Things cannot, whatever this point knows is independent of, just whatever happens over there is ignorant of whatever the outside black hole. Anyways, another way of putting this requirement on causality, for causality, is to say that the laws of matter fields are locally causal, and that's what we assume, of course, if signals can be sent between events Q and P in our geodesically convex region, U, only if and only if there is a curve which connects Q to P, whose tangent vectors are all non-space-like. Non-space-like, we mean, of course, that it could be either, the tangent vectors could be time-like or light-like. Which is to say that the laws of nature are causal. If signals can be sent between events Q and P, if and only if the signal travels on a path whose tangent vector, whose tangent vectors gamma dot, have negative lengths with respect to the matrix, negative or zero. Now here's the surprising thing. Let's say we have a differential manifold, and let's say that we are not given the metric on the manifold. However, we are given a piece of the metric. We are given a little bit of the information that the metric would give us. Namely, we are given the causal structure of the manifold. Which is to say that for an arbitrary vector on the manifold, we cannot evaluate what its length is. That would mean that we know the metric. But instead, let's say we are only given enough information to evaluate whether the length is negative, zero, or positive. This is to say that we are given the causal structure. If for any tangent vector we can tell whether it is having length negative, zero, or positive, we can tell whether a particular direction can be traveled. Because if it's space-like, it cannot be traveled by any object or light. If it's light-like, it can be traveled by light. If it's time-like, it can be traveled by any object. So let us assume that we are given as the only information the causal structure of the metric. Then we can ask, well, how much of the metric does this determine? How much of the metric do we know? If all we know is the size of the length of vectors. It turns out we nearly know the metric completely. And that's quite surprising, of course, for Riemannian manifolds, there is no such element. At the end, I'll try to make it plausible why it's not all that surprising. But at the beginning, as a positive. So here's the theorem. Assume that a differential manifold M, that on a differential manifold M, we don't know the metric, so we cannot evaluate the metric on two tangent vectors. Remember, the metric is twofold covariant, the twofold covariant that tensor, and we can feed these two tangent vectors. So assume we are not given that information. We don't know what the outcome of that calculation would be. However, let's assume we know at every point of the manifold the sign of the length of any vector psi, only whether it's negative, zero, or positive. Just the sign. So we don't know the actual length, just the sign of the length. Well, the claim is that this information alone already determines the metric tensor up to what is called the conformal transformation. Which is to say that from that information, we can actually calculate g mu of x and g mu of x times some positive function c of x that is not determined. So up to some positive scalar function, this information determines g mu of x. Now g mu of x, as I write it here, is the metric tensor in the basis of the P by DXI, in the canonical basis that comes with the choice of coordinate system. Because if we chose, you know, some tetrad, then of course the metric tensor would always be theta P mu. And then all the non-trivial information would be in the specification of the tetrad. So let us look at it for now from the point of view of the coordinate system being used basis of the tangent and cotangent spaces.
Sorry, what's the x here? Is it a point or is it?
Yes, these are points.
Okay.
Points of the length. And by the way, from now on we will interchangeably use the terminology of point and event. Mathematicians would call, you know, an element of the manifold a point, and physicists in the case of space time would call it an event. Remember that the a tetrad would be a frame, also normal system of basis vectors, that diagonalizes the metric. When we write the tensor such as the metric tensor, using the basis for the tangential cotangential space that comes automatically with the first coordinate, then we also say that we work in the so-called canonical frame, because it comes canonically with the coordinate system. It is also called the holonomic frame. What does it mean that we have that? What does the claim mean that the metric is determined up to conformal, scalar, positive prefactor? What it means that everything except for the length of vectors is determined. So remember that conformal transformations affect only the length of vectors but leave their angles invariant. If you take two tangent vectors psi and eta, and you can calculate their angle, of course, on a space time, this need not come out real, because lengths can come out negative. But you can still write down an expression. That is the generalized angle between two vectors. And if you now multiply the metric with a positive scalar, then you get the same factor in front of here as you get in front of there, because it occurs twice in here, but you can take the square root of it. And therefore, any conformal factor in front drops out. This means that the information that is gained if we know only the sign of the length of vectors, if we know just the cross information, that information is enough to tell us about all angles between any vectors, any tangent vectors on the space-time, but not about lengths. Because conformal transformations are indeterminate here, and conformal transformations can change the length of the vector, but not the angles between them. So now let's prove this to see how that comes about. Then let's consider a time-like vector, tangent vector psi at a particular point p. Let's consider a time-like vector psi and a space-like vector and a space-like vector eta. So the length of this vector is negative and the length of that vector is positive. Then let's ask, are there linear combinations of those two vectors with some linear combination factor lambda such that the linear combination is lifelike? Remember, this thing has negative length, that thing has positive length. Is there a linear combination such that the sum of the two vectors has length to zero? One would expect so. Let's see. See, the point is that if there is such a value for lambda, such that the vector has length zero, then actually by our assumption of knowing the causal structure, we know lambda. Because knowing the causal structure of the spacetime is to know when a vector has length of zero. So if we can tell when a vector has length zero, it means we can tell when lambda has the right value such that this linear combination is zero. Okay, so we have to check whether indeed, lambda can be chosen such that the length of this vector is zero. Well, let us calculate the length of this vector, and let's define the length of the vector, f of lambda, as, you know, plug this vector into the metric. That gives us the length squared. And we have to check whether that is positive or negative or zero. If we write it up in coordinates, it's g mu, and then psi mu plus lambda eta mu, etc. We are setting this equal to zero. For which lambdas do we have a solution? And more precisely, are there any lambdas for which this holds true? And we should require that lambda is real value. Because if lambda is not real value, then this is not a legal vector dependent space, because the tangent vectors are real. the tangent vector space is a real vector space. So we have to require that lambda is real value, but is it real value? Let's see. The equation star, this one, is a polynomial of degree 2 in lambda. You see it explicitly over here. It's very simple. It's a polynomial of degree 2 in lambda. Therefore, we know automatically that it has two roots, two lambdas, such that this is zero. But are they complex or are they real? Turns out they have to be real. And we see it in the following way. We know that psi is time-like. Length is negative. Which means that if we set lambda equal to zero, so that we have only the length of psi, so f of 0 is negative. We know that. And we also know that eta, if it were alone in this, that eta has positive length. Now, if we choose lambda sufficiently large, then the vector eta completely dominates over the vector psi. Psi is a vector of negligible length compared to the vector lambda eta. Therefore, for sufficiently large lambda, we get that f of lambda is positive. And therefore, we know from calculus that f of lambda being a polynomial in lambda and being negative for some values of lambda and positive for some other value of lambda has to go through zero somewhere. Therefore, this equation must have at least one real root. There must be at least one real value for lambda for which this equation holds true. But then we know also from algebra that if we have a polynomial which has one real root, the other root is also. Because remember how it works if one root is complex, then the other one is a complex polynomial. So we know that both roots are real.
But how do we know that the point where it passes it is?
Well, at the moment we're not interested at the moment in exactly which the value is. I'm just saying that always there are two real values for lambda which make that equation hold. And by assumption, we can determine those values of lambda. Because we can find out at every tangent vector space exactly which are the vectors that have length zero. So therefore, by our assumption that we know the causal structure of the space, which is to say that we can tell the sign of the lengths of vectors. By that assumption, we can assume that lambda 1 and lambda 2 are null. But they can be determined from that information of just having the sign of the length of the vector. So we have lambda 1 and lambda 2 null. But that actually means that we know the ratio between lengths of vectors already. What we know is that the ratio between lengths of vectors is lambda 1 and lambda 2. Now, since we know lambda 1 and lambda 2, we can assume that we know them. It means that we can calculate the ratio between the lengths of any two vectors. Okay? Let us prove this. Well, any two vectors where psi is, of course, assumed to be time-like, and eta is assumed to be space-like. Let's see that this is really so. It's not hard to prove. So by assumption, we know the two values of lambda, lambda 1 and lambda 2, which make this equation hold. Let us spell it out, what this really is. This is the length of the vector psi, lambda 1 squared, length of the vector eta, and then this twice the mixed term. This is the equation that we obtain if we choose the solution lambda 1 in this. And we can write out a similar equation when we choose the solution lambda 2. So we have those two equations. We have lambda 1 and lambda 2 in this. Now in those two equations, g of psi and eta occur. We can eliminate g of psi and eta from those two equations and obtain a new equation. And that new equation is this one, the one that we have to prove. Namely, that the length of the timeline vector divided by the length or length squared of the space-like vector is known at this lambda 1 times lambda 2. It's a little exercise for you to just show that this is really how it comes out. Pretty trivial. Now, that's the corollary. If we know, if we can assume, therefore, the knowledge of the ratio of any time-like vector's length divided by any space-like vector's length, we can actually also determine, and therefore assume known, the ratios between any two time-like vector's lengths. And how does that come about? Well, if psi is a time-like vector, eta is a space-like vector, then we just showed that their ratio can be assumed known. Therefore, if we choose another time-like vector, and the same space-like vector, their ratio is also known, because all of those lambdas are always known. But then if we divide the two equations by another, this g of eta and eta drops out. And therefore, we obtain that also the ratio between one time-like vector's length and another time-like vector's length, or length squared, really, is known, because expressible in terms of lambdas. A corollary of this is the following. Let's consider now some arbitrary non-null vectors. We choose a non-null, not of length zero, because we may want to divide by lengths of vectors, and so it better not be zero. Then let's do the following trick. We can write the inner product of the two tangent vectors, alpha and beta, with respect to the metric, in this way. That's nothing deep, it's a trivial thing. Just work out what this is. If you spell it out, this is g of alpha alpha plus g of beta beta and the mixed terms, right? And the g of alpha alpha drops out with this, g of beta beta drops out with that, and the mixed term gets multiplied with minus 1 half, but it comes with a 2 because it's a mixed term, so it's exactly that. Okay. Then we divide the entire equation here by g of psi and psi. So g of alpha comma beta divided by g of psi psi, and all those terms here all just get divided by g of psi psi. Now you see what's going on here. This is simply the ratio between some tangent vector, some tangent vector's length, and another tangent vector's length. Here we have some tangent vector's length and another tangent vector's length. And here the same thing. Some tangent vector's length and another tangent vector's length. The key trick that we make here is that we wrote the inner product between two different vectors using just lengths of the same vector. And remember that what we showed just as part of our fix, that the ratio between the lengths of vectors can always be assumed known. Therefore, that inner product here can be assumed known up to that function. You may not know that function directly, because we only know the ratios of lengths, not the lengths absolutely. So, the point is that we can reach the conclusion that if it is known which vectors are tangent, which vectors are space-like, and which vectors are not, none. And if that's the only information that we're given, then it is possible to calculate the inner product between two arbitrary vectors, g, alpha, and beta, at all points of the manifold, for all alpha and beta, through this formula here, and that is assumed given, and we can actually calculate numerically what that number is, what that number is, and what that number is, because they're all just expressed in terms of lambdas, which can be determined explicitly. Except that this little piece here is a length of a vector that we don't know. So we can calculate g alpha beta exactly except for a positive prefactor function, a scalar positive prefactor function. See, remember psi, well, actually, in this case, it's negative because we chose the psi to be tandem. But I might as well have chosen a space like g of eta and eta. Everything would be calculable. And then that would be just a positive prefactor. So without generality, without restricting generality, we can say that knowing only the causal structure of the manifold, which is to say, if we know only where the light cones are pointing, then we can already reconstruct the inner product between any two vectors up to a controller prefactor. And this is what we set out to prove. So the implication is that the causal structure alone of the manifold already determines the angles between vectors precisely. Even though it's just really giving the light cone, the direction of the light cone, it already determines the angles. And the lengths of the vectors are only determined up to a scalar prefactor. And in a way, that is not so surprising in hindsight that we have this much of ambiguity, because remember that we assumed to know the lengths of vectors, not entirely, but only their sign. Right? We only know whether the length of the vector, the length square of a vector, is negative zero or positive. And that simply maintained. The fact that we get the metric only up to a scalar prefactor, a positive scalar prefactor, sorry, I should put here positive up to a positive. It's simply expressing that again, and that we're not assuming knowledge of. Some remarks. Spacetimes given by a differential manifold, you know, the chart and everything, and the metric, and another manifold with another metric g tilde, which differ only by a conformal transformation. So if the manifold, the differential manifold is the same, but the metrics differ by some scalar positive prefactor, then we will say that they are causally equivalent. They have the same causal structure because they have the same light cones. They agree on what is which paths can be traveled, which paths cannot be traveled, which paths are space-like, which are time or light-like. And therefore, we group such manifolds into the same, what is called, conformal equivalence class. They're conformally equivalent. They're equivalent up to a conformal prefactor. This is not just need to know the fact that the causal structure determines the metric up to a conformal factor, but it could also be quite useful later on to separate those degrees of freedom from the degrees of freedom that describe the causal structure and the degrees of freedom that describe the conformal structure. They are, in certain circumstances, pretty well separated from each other, and we just saw the first instance of this. And later in this lecture today, we'll see another instance. The fact that the causal structure can be separated from the conformal structure in this way is also useful for illustration purposes. I hope you've all seen Penrose diagrams, or you may have heard of Penrose diagrams. The idea there is that if you study a spacetime, such as that of a black hole, then it may be inconvenient to have to use a piece of paper to draw a spacetime. But you can make use of the fact that the causal structure stays the same even when you apply a conformal transformation. So the idea behind Penrose diagrams is that you locally shrink or expand your spacetime by applying a conformal transformation that changes the length of vectors, in such a way that you're not affecting the angles. You're just doing a conformal transformation. So Penrose diagrams are diagrams that you draw to study the causal, in order to make causal investigations of the space-time, disregarding possible conformal aspects. So you pick in this equivalence class of conformally equivalent space-times the one representative that is easiest to draw.
So, but what purpose would be achieved by just expanding the space-time?
No, I'm just saying that if you have a space-time, you can often shrink, for example, infinity right into a finite region in this way. You can keep the causal structure by allowing yourself, and even but you can do a study of the causal structure, have a nice picture to draw. And you're not changing the causal structure if you apply conformal transformation.
No, but that's what I'm asking. How does shrinking or expanding the space time allow you to develop a nice picture?
Well, because you can either push things out to infinity or drag them, roughly speaking. I hope to have more time later on to give you specific examples of that. So under the conformal transformation, where the metric goes into a new metric just by using a conformal factor, the shape of the manifold will change, and therefore the Riemann tensor changes, but one part of the Riemann tensor stays constant. And that's what I was referring to a while ago, namely that one can really relatively cleanly separate the conformal degrees of freedom from those that are not conformal degrees of freedom. And here's how that works. The Riemann curvature tensor can be written as all of this stuff, don't worry about the details of it, it doesn't matter for the moment what the details are. So the Riemann curvature tensor can be written as all of this stuff plus the rest. It can certainly be done. Okay. Riemann curvature tensor is this plus the rest. And the rest we call C. The C tensor, C A M S Q. Same indices as the Riemann curvature tensor. And this thing will be called the Y tensor. Now, why would one choose to split the Riemann curvature tensor in this particular way? Why would we define a tensor which is the Riemann curvature tensor minus all of that stuff? Well, it is because in this way we are separating two sets of degrees of freedom. Remember that in space-time, A runs from 0 to 3, M does so, S and Q as well. Which means that we have 4 to the power of 4 entries in this big matrix, which is quite a few. However, they are not all really independent. There are lots of symmetries and anti-symmetries in this, and therefore, really, this thing has only 20 non-trivial entries. It turns out that those guys here have only 10 non-trivial entries, and the Y tensor has the remaining 10. Now, why would we split in this particular way? First of all, it is a covariant thing to do. Everything that we wrote in here on those terms are covariant terms. Nothing is just completely arbitrary and coordinate system dependent. This is a coordinate system independent definition of the Y curvature tensor. But more than that, if you look at this thing closely, you will see that it contains only the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor. It does not contain the full curvature tensor. Those terms here depend only on the curvature scalar and on the Ricci tensor, the R with the two indices. And that's the reason why the Riemann curvature tensor depends only on 10 degrees of freedom. The scalar R and the Ricci tensor with the two, the R with the two indices contain together only 10 degrees of freedom out of those 20. What would be the significance of this? Well, to see the significance of that split, let us look at the Einstein equation, and let us look at conformal transformations. First, conformal transformations. The key proposition here, which we won't prove, is that if two metrics are conformally equivalent, so they differ only by a scalar prefactor, then the Bayer tensors are the same. The Riemann curvature tensors are not the same. Of course not. But the Y tensors are the same. And by the way, it's also useful to know that the Y curvature tensor has the same symmetry with respect to interchanging indices and so on, as does the Riemann curvature tensor. Okay, so we keep one thing in mind. The Y tensor does not change under conformal transformation. Now, secondly, this was the mathematical significance of the Y curvature tensor. What is the physical significance of the Y curvature tensor? Well, to see that, just rewrite the Einstein equation. It is a curious feature that has been commented on a lot, but I don't think it's fully understood, that the Einstein equation in four dimensions, and only in four dimensions, that is to say in 3+1 dimensions, has a curious self-dual property. And the Einstein equation can also be written in this way. This is also the Einstein equation, completely equivalent. You see, here you have the Ricci tensor, which is the two indices, and here you have t mu minus 1/2 g mu t. If you simply replace r by t and t by r and make 8 pi g go into 1 over 8 pi g, then you would get the actual equation in the way that you should. So there's this strange duality between r and t. Only 2 in 3+1 dimensions. But you're not going to focus on the duality here. Let's just take it for a fact, and I invite you to prove as an exercise that really from the regular Einstein equation you can obtain that form of the equation. And t is, of course, just a contraction, total contraction of t mu. So you take t mu, it's just contracting. So we're not focused on the fact that we have this strange duality between r and t in the Einstein equation, which may or may not be p. Let's just look at what this equation is, what the Einstein equation says in this form. But the main thing it says is that if there is no energy momentum, then there is no Ricci curvature. Okay? If there is no matter in the universe, or if there is no matter in a certain patch of the universe, then the Ricci part of the curvature tensor is vanishing. We know there are 10 degrees of freedom in that. There are 20 degrees of freedom in the full Riemann curvature tensor, only 10 in this. And those 10 are tied up with energy momentum. Energy momentum is vanishing, there is no Ricci curvature. See, the terminology I'm using here is that those 10 degrees of freedom in here are called Ricci curvature, and the 10 degrees of freedom locked up in the Y tensor are called Y curvature. So what we see is that the Ricci curvature is tied to matter, whereas the Y curvature is not tied. What does that mean? Well, if the Ricci tensor, the Ricci curvature is tied to matter, but the Y curvature is not, it's completely independent of that, then the Y curvature, its 10 degrees of freedom, describe free gravity. Those degrees of freedom describe gravitational waves. This distinction was initially lost on Einstein, And he had, he initially came up with a theory that was not general relativity. He had some wrong mechanics. So historically, he went about this way. He considered the equivalence class of space-times let us consider the equivalence class of space-times and the integers that are conformally and therefore causally equivalent to Minkowski space. And that is what Einstein was interested in as the minimum modification to Newtonian gravity. He said, maybe Minkowski space is not so bad after all, and maybe the real space-time is simply described by a Minkowski metric times some conformal factor. Maybe that's all there is. After all, according to Newton, gravity has just 1 degree of freedom. Gravity has just the gravitational potential. That's all. And so he thought maybe this is the relativistic generalization of the Newtonian potential. Einstein and a fellow called Fokker first pursued that theory, in which the metric possesses only those conformal degrees of freedom. Right? Only conformal degrees of freedom. So, in this case, he still wrote down the correct action, but the variational principle was restricted because he didn't allow all variations of the metric, but only conformal ones. And if you do that, then the Einstein equation simplifies dramatically. The equation of motion that corresponds to that variational principle, where you only vary with respect to conformal fluctuations, conformal variations, is that the Ricci scalar is equal to 8 pi g, and the energy momentum scalar. One thing that we can immediately see is wrong with this is that T mu nu is actually the T mu nu, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, is for example zero in the case of electromagnetism. So in that theory, light, even though it carries energy, wouldn't gravitate. Now, of course, it's not easy to see the gravitational effect of gravity, and therefore that's not how they ruled out the theory at the beginning. And initially, it didn't look so bad. The equivalence principle is okay because you still have locally special relativity. But it turned out that the light bending above the sun and also the calculation of the energy repairing energy came out wrong. So that theory wasn't. And also, the theory doesn't have gravitational waves because the Weyl tensor repairing energy. Okay, so much for the local causal structure. Let us now look at the global causal structure. Time travel and that sort of thing. Not that I will give you a recipe for time travel, but at least the language for it. Okay. So we will say that a manifold with a metric is time-orientable, and that is apparently, as we will see now, a non-trivial thing. Is time-orientable if at each point P of the manifold we can separate non-space-like factors non-space-like vectors, so tangent vectors of negative lengths or zero lengths, into two classes. Those that point to the future and those that point to the past. See, it's one thing to be able to say whether a vector is space-like or time-like. It's another thing to say for a time-like vector whether it's pointing towards the future or the past. And there are many folds where you can always tell whether a vector is time-like or space-like. I mean, whenever you have the metric, you can tell. And yet, you cannot tell whether something is pointing, whether a time-like vector is pointing towards the future or the past. There may not be a definition, a consistent, continuous definition of future and past. There may not be a classification of time-like vectors into future-directed or past-directed time-like vectors. Let us consider, for example, the outside of a Coke can. And that would be a model for a two-dimensional manifold, space-time manifold. So let's say time points in this direction and space goes around. Okay? So everything happens on the surface of this cylinder. And I drew an example of light cones. This is the light cone for that point, this is the light cone for that point, this is the light cone for that point. You can imagine that as you go around the can, those light cones turn and rotate until they rotate, and when you come back to the original point, they've rotated by 180 degrees. But what does that mean? It means that if you started out by saying that this is the future, and that is the past, for example, then you would say, okay, this is future, this is past. So this is future, this is future. You see where this is going? And as you go once round, you end up declaring that this is the future here. And therefore, by continuity, you would have to say that this is the future. Right? So it can easily happen that there is no continuous assignment of what is future and what is past on our manifold. In this case, you would say that the manifold is not time-oriented. Obviously, we would want to assume that...
But how are you rotating the thing? How are you rotating the thing?
The metric may simply be such that this is what happens. Right? You could have a metric such that the light cones slowly rotate in order to come back with a 180-degree shift. See? I mean, personally, I think this is worse than closed time light loops, right? Where you could travel into the past and so on. Because if you travel around this thing here, then what would happen is that not only would you return back to the event where you started, but when you return, everything goes backwards. All right? So you would enter university, and then a graduate, go to high school, and go back to kindergarten and all things. So this is not the reason. But isn't it amazing that general relativity allows for that? In principle, that could be a space-time in which we could, in principle, live in a space-time where this is the case. And if we only traveled far enough, we would return back here and find that time runs backwards. And of course, general relativity doesn't have thermodynamics built into it. At least most people would think so, even though there are some interesting attempts in this direction. But you know, for thermodynamic reasons, we would expect that this is not what happens. Because it would mean that there's no thermodynamic error of time either. It would mean that the same way that you can open an egg and make sunny side up breakfast, you could undo this. That is not likely to be possible. So now here's a dilemma. If the manifold is time-orientable, then there exists smooth, meaning continuous, differentiable, non-vanishing time-like vector fields V on the manifold. If such a smooth time-like vector field is given, and you can think of it as being a vector field that points for you into the future direction. So, assume that such a time-like vector field, smooth time-like vector field, is given. Then we can define at each point P of the manifold what are future-directed and what are past-directed vectors, simply by saying that the future-directed vectors are those vectors that have an inner product with V that is positive, because they roughly point the same direction. They have a positive angle with it. Whereas all those tangent vectors, all those time-like or light-like tangent vectors psi, which have a negative inner product with our reference vector field V, you would say are past-directed. And of course, alternatively, you could swap around the future and past designation globally. Why can we always do that? But for that purpose, it might be convenient to remember that we can choose the basis in our tangent spaces arbitrarily. In particular, we can choose a frame in such a way that the metric tensor is just EW nu. In this case, our reference vector field, V, can be chosen through a Lorentz transformation, and we allow ourselves local Lorentz transformations when we choose a frame such that this is true. but this is only fixing the frame up to log log. So I think we can always choose it such that our time back vector has zero components in the space dimension. Well, then the inner product between our reference vector and our vector psi is simply V naught times psi naught. And now we see that this is a very direct way of defining whether psi is pointing towards the future or to the past, simply by checking what the sign of this is. Because V naught, the log is positive, so it's the sign of psi that in a smooth fashion determines whether psi is pointing into the future or into the past. From now on, we will only consider time-orientable spacetimes. And we always assume that some time orientation has been chosen. Okay. Now we need some definitions in order to be able to talk about the things that will be coming up when we talk about singularities here. First of all, what are time-like curves? So we know what time-like curves are. They are curves whose tangent vector is, at every point, time. More precisely, a curve or a path on a space-time is called future-directed time-like, and similarly, of course, past-directed time-like, if each tangent vector, gamma dot, is the future-directed time-like vector. Meaning no, it has positive inner product with the reference vector field V. By the way, our paths don't have to run forever. They could just have a limited range of parameter scopes. So we could be mapping in the interval from 0 to 1 into the manifold, or also entire R into the manifold. And this sort of thing will later be important when we have our paths run into singularity. A little subtlety is that future-directed time-like curves cannot have tangent vectors that have length zero, because then they would be null. They would be lifelike. Okay, so a little subtlety is that future-directed time-like curves cannot have tangent vectors of length zero. Therefore, another definition is that a curve is called future-directed causal if each tangent vector to the curve is a future-directed non-spacetime vector. So now we allow it to be time-like or even. So causal will be a key word later on. It means time-like or. So in other words, a light-like future-directed path can be traveled by matter. Sorry, a time-like future-directed path can be traveled by matter, but a causal future-directed path may or may not be traveled by matter. It could be that it has some stretches in which it's going with the speed of light, so only light could travel. And similarly, you define, of course, path-directed time-like or path-directed causal curves. So now we can define the past and the future of an event. Again, in ordinary Newtonian classical theory, there wouldn't be such a thing, because the future of an event is all of the future. And the past of an event is all of the past. It's not depending on the event. But in general relativity, the speed of propagation of any sort of effect and information is finite, and therefore the future is always contingent on the event that you consider the future of, and similarly for the past. So here's one key definition. The chronological future of An event is the set I class of the event. And it is the set of all events that can be reached from P on a future-directed time-like curve. Let me give you a mnemonic help in this. The chronological future is the set of all those events that can be reached by clocks, for example. You know, chronos means time, or means the clocks. So if a clock can actually travel the path in question, then it's part of the chronological future, or the chronological path. You're not allowing travel with the speed of light for the chronological future. You see, traveling with the speed of light is not, in all circumstances, equivalent to taking the limit of going faster and faster and faster. And so we have to separate those two issues. And I'm showing you in a moment why that is so. Why you can't simply say that, well, if you just go fast enough, then it's with the speed of light, and therefore we just cover one case. We really have to take the two cases separately, at least in the classical theory. Okay, so the chronological future of an event is called capital I plus, and it's a set of all events that can be reached on paths that never exceed the speed of light. In fact, they never reach the speed of light. Okay? So even clocks could travel that path. This is how you can remember that this is called a chronological future, because even clocks can travel that path.
It's still not. Don't understand why are we excluding the speed of light?
We're getting to that. Getting to that. It's too early. I can't tell before another difference. Okay, now I plus is always an open subset of the manifold, because, as you can intuitively imagine, if gamma is some time-like future-directed curve, and by the way, I'm talking general curves, not geodesics. Geodesics are just a subset. No, arbitrary curves, right? So capital I plus is always an open subset of the manifold, because if gamma is one of those time-like future-directed curves, starting from P, then any sufficiently small perturbation of the path is still a time-like future-directed curve. Basically, if you're traveling slower than the speed of light, you can always go really fast. Or a little bit slower too. So therefore, it's an open set. By the way, since for the chronological future, propagation with the speed of light is excluded by definition, tangent vectors of length 0 are excluded. Technically, the event itself is not in its own chronological future, because from the event to the event, you have a vector of length 0, namely the 0. And it is technically excluded, so this point is not part of its chronological future. Except on spacetimes where there is a closed time-like curve, where you can travel into the future, going to wormholes or whatever, and you come back through the past to the same event. Just a sec. In this case, it would be in its own chronological future.
Doesn't a closed timeline curve have to be past directed at some point?
I know. No, that's the thing. It doesn't have to be. Yeah, that's what I said. Remember that it's two different things. The existence of a closed time-like curve is separate. It's a separate question whether that exists or not from the question whether you can everywhere consistently in a smooth fashion say what is future and what is past. So you can have manifolds in which you cannot say what is future and what is past in a smooth fashion, like users can outside, right? And that doesn't mean that you can have a closed time-like loop. On the other hand, you can have a manifold in which you can always say what is future and what is past. And yet, you can have a manifold in which at every point you can consistently, in a smooth fashion, say that these vectors are pointing to the future and those vectors are pointing to the past. And yet, you might have a closed time-like loop. So the two things are independent of one another. Basically, because it's a local thing, right? Whether you can say whether there is whether you can also sign up for future open paths. Okay, now as opposed to the chronological future of an event, where we excluded things traveling with the speed of light, we now look at the definition of the causal future of an event, J plus of A and B, and this is consisting of all events that could be influenced by P, by things going on at P, with matter propagating with the speed of light or slow. So now we do allow tangent vectors to pass from P to the event in question that may or may not reach the speed of light. So events in the causal future may not all be reachable by an actual observer. A clock may not travel, cannot travel with the speed of light. So the causal future contains events that cannot be reached by matter, but by light. And in this case, we have that the event itself, P, is always part of its causal future, because we allow tangent vectors of zero length. And of course, the tangent vector of the path that goes from P and stays at P has zero length, and so it's part of it. And similarly, of course, one can define a chronological path by minus of P, consisting of all those events that could have influenced our event P through things traveling slower than the speed of light. And the causal path consists of all the events that could have, that may have been influenced our event P with things that may have traveled with the speed of light or slow. Now we can look at a set of points. Instead of just looking at one point, we can look at a set of points. For example, we can look at this room at one point in time in our obvious coordinate system. Now, we can look at this room at one point in time. That's a whole collection of events. And then we can ask, what's the future of this set of events? And what is the path of this set of events? But let's call such a set of events S. And then we define the chronological future or past of this set of events to be the union of the chronological futures or past of all the individual events. But obvious and similarly, with the causal future and causal past of this set of events, it's just the union of the causal futures and past of all the individual events that make up our set S. The fourth definition is that of the boundary of the causal future of a set of events, J dot, and the boundary of the chronological future or past of a set of events, which we denote by I dot. And you could imagine that, well, if you just take the dot over this, you would get something like a J. It's the boundary of it, right? Remember, we have the chronological future, for example, of an event or set of events. And then we know that it's an open set. And what we're missing there, the boundary, would seem to be the stuff that we reach by traveling with the speed of light. So if we take the boundary into account, are we just going from chronological to causal? But in costly space, that's so. And also in sufficiently small regions of curved space, indeed. But you know, not necessarily so when you have singularity. Let's see how that happens. Let's look at geodesics. The above definitions did not refer to geodesics in particular. Geodesics were, of course, eligible paths, but we were looking at all sorts of paths, all smooth paths that were time-life or light. Now, for Minkowski space, everything that can be reached by some path can be reached by geodesic as well. So from Minkowski space, we have that the chronological future of an event is also the set of events which are reachable by future-directed anti-geodesics. If we restrict attention to simply geodesics, we're not losing anything, because everything can be reached by the geodesics. And the closure of that set, of the chronological future, is the set of events reachable by future-directed non-geodesics from P. But this is not true in general space-time. Roughly speaking, the reason is that if you restrict attention to geodesics, then in order to reach a certain point in the future, you have only one geodesic that can get you there. In Minkowski space, no problem. You take that geodesic. But in curved space, there could be singularity in a way, in which case there is no geodesic that gets you through that singularity into that point. In other words, the singularity could cast a shadow towards the future in this picture. And this will be one of the key techniques for identifying singularities and for studying the need for the occurrence of singularities and so on. So even though that may happen in curved space-times, it won't happen if you look at sufficiently small regions in space-times where you are having where you always have just one geodesic that connects two points and there's no singularity. So there's a theorem that says that locally on a curved space-time the situation is always like in Minkowski space. Assume P is some point of the manifold, and assume that U, a subset of the manifold, is a convex normal neighborhood of P, meaning that they need to events in that neighborhood are connected by exactly one geodesic. Then, the theorem maintains, the chronological future of the event, restricted to the patch U that we are considering here, is the set of events reachable by future-directed geodesics from P, just like in Minkowski space. It's only that we have to restrict attention here to a patch of space time, it's a pretty small patch. And also, the closure of that chronological future of that event is a set of events reachable by future directed non-geodesics of P. And just like in Minkowski space, if Q is an event which is in the causal future but is not in the chronological future, then any causal curve between P and Q is a non-geodesic. So the difference between the two, the difference between the causal future and the chronological future, the difference between all those points that can be reached by and value, and the set of points that can be reached only by matter, that difference consists exactly of points that can be reached by geodesics that are light. In other words, there's not going to be any shadows of singularities for sufficiently small regions. And this is what we will have to follow up when we are to identify two singularities. Okay. Any questions? No questions? So we'll meet again on Thursday for a long session. Any questions in Waterloo or McMaster or Web? Okay, see you then. Bye-bye.